This is episode 62 of Radio Freethinker on CITR Radio, our election special.
That impels him to display in this way.
Right now!
And welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
This is Don, your political science and philosopher.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and conference attendee.
This is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers and economics student here at UBC.
And that's it. So, gentlemen, how are you? How's your week going?
Pretty good.
Actually,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm working on my research right now at the lab, and I'm presenting it at a conference this weekend in Bellingham, and I'm still working on analyzing the data and putting together a poster.
Interesting. So everyone now knows that you're very unprepared.
Anyone in Bellingham, ignore that last little bit.
I'm probably no different from at least half the students that are presenting there.
Well, I have a interesting idea that I wanted to throw out here, just really off the cuff. The other day, I was driving home, and I noticed the car in front of me had one of those Flying Spaghetti Monster bumper stickers. And I was really excited because I wanted to pass along my mutual skeptical appreciation, but I had no method of doing so. I thought, you know, should I honk my horn? But he might interpret that as me being a jerk. So I thought, well, the only thing I can really do is speed up beside the guy and be like, yeah, Flying Spaghetti Monster. But that seemed kind of weird.
But the road rage would be the first thing that would come to my mind.
So I'm thinking, we as skeptics, we need a way to transmit our appreciation for noticing funny skeptical bumper stickers. I just wanted to throw that out there as a cause.
Does this really happen often enough to warrant this?
I've seen it a couple times. I saw one a few days ago that was the Jesus fish that said, in chips.
Okay.
So, I don't know. I have a Skeptical Inquirer one on the back of my car, so.
Perhaps some sort of hand signal, raising one of your fingers in support.
But the
just
right
one?
Kind of fingers, yes.
Okay.
I had some really good news this week, actually. I discovered I have a whole bunch more new relatives that I didn't know about. Apparently, we're somehow related to Neanderthals, for real.
Some of us more than others, actually. A news story is making the rounds, and turns out that Neanderthals and humans interbred a long time ago.
As interesting. Some, like, sweet human Neanderthal loving interbreeding?
Well, if you look at the genetics, right, you'd expect there to be some gene sharing between Neanderthals and humans because we had a common ancestor. But they did some extra research in developing the Neanderthal genome where they discovered that when they compared different types of Homo sapien genomes, they have one from France, one from China, one from Polynesia, and two from Africa. When you compare the genome bits that they have now, that they're more similar to those out of Africa than in Africa, implying that the genetic mixing happened after we migrated from Africa, i.e. after we had the common ancestor. So yeah, there was a bit of prehistoric diddling going on.
Although we should point out that there actually is still some controversy about this study, which we'll get to in a moment. So I just want to sort of summarize for listeners who maybe aren't too familiar. Neanderthals first appeared in the European fossil record about 400,000 years ago during the latter part of sort of human evolution. They lived in Europe and Western Asia, as far east as southern Siberia and as far south as the Middle East. Now, what it turns out is that humans and Neanderthals share between 1 and 4% of the same genes, sort of scattered throughout the human genome, which is kind of interesting. Now, the interesting aspect of this is, like Don mentioned, the first early migration out of Africa is when it's suspected that humans and Neanderthals, you know, got together and had some fun. And this would probably have taken place in the Middle East and not, in theory, in Europe. The reason why they're saying in the Middle East is because, like Don mentioned, it's limited to people of non-African descent, so mainly Europeans and Asians and people from Oceania.
Actually, and on that note, because they had two samples of African genetic information, they found that the Neanderthal DNA was equally distant from both of those, but not equally distant from the other three. So there is an added layer to that.
Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of interesting, because the first thing I thought about when I saw this story, does this imply then that Neanderthals and humans are the same species? One of the qualifications of being the same species is that you can have fertile offspring, which apparently you can.
So there were actually fertile Neanderthal-human offspring?
Well, we would have to assume so, since we're here.
Yeah, unless there's been recent breeding between Neanderthals and humans, which would be rather difficult unless you're into necrophilia, it would have to have been recent, because if you had a sterile offspring, they wouldn't pass on that mix of genes.
But see, the neat thing is, maybe neat depending on your point of view, some archaeologists are kind of saying, well, hold on a second, this is entirely done within the realm of genetics. There is very little to none archaeological or anthropological evidence of humans and Neanderthals interbreeding. So there's we can't find, you know, a skeleton that's, you know, Homo sapien and Neanderthal. So
sorry, now you're starting to sound like the creationist. Where is the missing
link?
Yeah,
where is the missing link, right? We should have a Homo Neanderthal or something. But again, I think it's a valid point that the archaeological evidence is not quite in sync with the genetic evidence.
Well, there's actually two things on this, one supporting, one against. The podcast that I was listening to was talking about this. I mentioned that there's actually a morphological disease you can get that actually gives you the bone structure of Neanderthals. I forget the name of it. But it was a podcast I was listening to on Quirks and Quarks, and they were talking about that. And they said, well, maybe the reason why this morphological disease occurs, and it's a bone structure, so you can actually do comparisons of archaeology, is its genetic link. The other side, and this goes against it, which I thought was kind of disturbing, is they had said that they had a frequency count of the genes of 1.4%, or something like, they've seen all the genes 1.4 times. Now, then they said, well, but we've only actually seen 60% of them once. Some of those we've seen two or three times, and some of them we haven't seen at all, which really left me scratching my head, saying, so you've seen them all 1.4 times, and somehow that also equates to only seeing some two or three times and some not at all. So they seemed really confident of this based on statistical analysis. But yeah, I think there's more research to be done. And the guy says there may be a lot more to be pulled out of this, but we just don't have the techniques. We don't have the granularity to do enough research.
And further on what Don was just saying here, I think that the media has kind of taken the story as, you know, humans and Neanderthals had wild sex orgies a little bit too far. Again, there is a perfectly interesting explanation, which you can find, and we'll link this in the show notes, the draft research that the leading, let me just see here, Savant Pablo of the Max Planck Institute of Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany, this is the organization that's leading the research, they've linked to their draft proposal. So you can go in and read it. And in that proposal, they do actually say that there are other explanations for this. Now, consider that Neanderthals and modern human ancestors share a common ancestor within the last 500,000 years. It's reasonable that there should be some relation between modern humans and Neanderthals. And if it was regionalized in Africa, perhaps North Africa, where the early human migration began, it could explain why African people do not share the similarity in genes. Interesting.
One of the things that they had said, too, was one of the differences they thought they were seeing were differences in cognitive ability. And, again, that raised a bit of a red flag because it's one of those things you'd expect. That's what you'd be expecting to find, is say, what makes us different than the Neanderthal? Well, we're smarter. We have bigger brains. And if you're seeing that in this data, I'm wondering how much of this is really there and how much of it they might just be wanting to see.
Yeah.
How do they find cognitive differences when you can't measure the cognitive abilities of a Neanderthal directly?
Right. So some of the genetic differences that they saw between the Neanderthal genome that they have and the human genome are some genes that they suspect are related to cognitive abilities. Again, there are so many ifs, ands, and maybes that, again, that was starting to raise the red flags for me, is that maybe they just really want this to be true, so they've got the confirmation type bias.
Isn't the traditional approach for measuring intelligence skull size, or more specifically the size that for the brain in the skull?
Yeah, and they have done that. I mean, we do have complete Neanderthal skulls that they've measured. So I mean, it's interesting. Like, I kind of have to agree with Don on this, is that I think we might be a little too enthusiastic about this one. And I think it's certainly very, very interesting, and I want to learn more. But I think we need to wait for more research to come through. And I think, you know, sort of, this is kind of reminds me of the whole Hobbit controversy. Archaeologists can get pretty into their little debates, and it's very fun for outsiders to watch and see which side, you know, ultimately proves the correct theory. So I encourage us and our listeners to keep listening for this one.
I think it's just cool that we actually have the genome of the Neanderthal sequenced.
Only 60% of it is done, though.
But they also have the mitochondrial DNA from the Neanderthal. I thought I remember hearing somewhere that we have the mitochondrial DNA from Neanderthals sequenced, and that evidence said there was no intermingling between them, which is why up until now it was like, oh, we didn't
interbreed
at all.
That's why this is such
a
big event if it turns out to be true, because it kind of flies in the face of previous evidence.
What we need to do now is find a mosquito that bit a Neanderthal encased in amber, and then do a Jurassic Park style thing. Create Neanderthals from scratch and ask them ourselves.
Yeah.
Because that's easy.
Right. Actually, you know, the mitochondrial DNA might actually explain Ethan's question about are they separate species or not, because it's possible that we got our mitochondrial DNA from our mothers, that this genetic mix was incompatible or sterile in Neanderthals, so all their children were sterile because it was incompatible, but humans were more adaptable for that.
Okay, well, why don't we go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with more on Radio Freethinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in 5 words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Now, another news story that's sort of making the rounds is teachers converting to Catholicism to get jobs.
Now, are these genuine conversions, or are they, you know, I'll say whatever you want in order to get a job?
Well, we don't quite know just yet, but here's the story. Here's what's going down. In Ontario, teachers are finding it very hard to land a job, so they're pursuing some new and interesting methods. In 2009, 12,200 new teachers entered the job market, aiming to fill 5,000 positions.
That is a huge competition.
Yeah. So, option for teachers is to land themselves one of that, you know, cool Catholic school positions. Unfortunately, they kind of want you to be Catholic to teach. So, got to convert.
How discriminatory.
I know.
I was actually confused, and I haven't done a lot of research in this, so you guys hopefully will inform me in this. But is it the fact that the Catholic Church or Catholic schools are hiring more teachers, or is it the fact that there's a out of that 12,000 or whatever, there only 1,000 are Catholic, therefore it's a much smaller pool to compete with? Do we know which way
I don't know, actually. That's a good question, though. I would imagine that the growth of secular schools and secularization in the education system is making probably a shortage of qualified, you know, new teachers. Probably there's plenty of, you know, older teachers that can do it, but I'm sure to get new, fresh blood into the system, they're going to have to, you know, find some religious people who have gone through the education program.
I imagine that the Catholic schools either use a different union or don't have a union for the teachers, so I guess the job opening process there is probably separate from other schools.
So is what's happening is these teachers are seeing openings that they would otherwise not be able to apply for or get unless they were Catholic?
Essentially. So what's happening is teachers are converting to Catholicism to get a job. Now, they can't just say, I'm a Catholic, let me in. They actually need a note from their priest. And then they're just showing, like, look, I'm a Catholic, here it is. And it's actually quite, well, it's kind of interesting for me, but it's, I think it does say a certain, raises certain questions about these teachers. I mean, if you're just converting to get a job, how, you know, how honest is your faith at that point?
That might explain, too, why not as many of these teachers are going into the Jewish school system.
Well, you know, there is no Jewish school system. It's only for Catholics and Protestants, which is also kind of, But anyway, moving on. Now, not only does it raise questions about, say, your morality if you're going to just convert to get a job, but it also raises questions about your standards. If you're prepared to teach, for instance, that a person can walk on water and raise the dead, what does that say about you as a teacher?
Well, I was actually talking to a friend of mine about this, and I was thinking, you know, maybe this would be a great way for those hardcore atheists like myself to actually get in there, get this job, try and pass all things, and then once I'm in there and I'm teaching the kids, I'll just say, okay, kids, let me tell you the real story.
And then they'd probably fire you and throw you out on your ass.
Just leave copies of the God Delusion lying around. Yeah.
Well, there are people who do say that this is a very silly and antiquated system, and they ask, they say, well, why do I need religion to teach morals and ethics?
Yeah,
that's indeed what is being taught.
That's what I was just thinking, is it's not necessarily that the teachers are being unscrupulous in just saying that they're Catholics in order to get jobs. It's the fact that they have to be Catholics in order to get jobs, which is incredibly discriminatory. And
well,
I you know, there's something wrong when your school system requires teachers to pretend they're Catholic in order to teach.
Well, see, that's the question, though. Like, where is the autonomy here, though? If they're a private school, do they not have the ability to place limitations on whoever they wish? I mean, they could say that you can't wear a hat, or, you know, you have to wear a blue shirt.
Or you have to wear, you know, the school uniform. But, I mean, as we've discussed on the show before, probably these schools are getting public funding.
They definitely are getting public funding. And if they are, does that not mean they need to abide government rules regarding discrimination?
That actually leads me up to a story that I heard about just the other day about a teacher, I believe in Vancouver here, who was dismissed because her partner had a baby. She was hired in a Catholic school, and she applied for maternity leave, and they said, maternity leave, but you're not pregnant. She said, well, it's not for me. My partner is. Oh, and by the way, I'm a lesbian. And they went, oh, well, that's nice, but no, you can't get maternity leave. Then a little while later, apparently she released a video, although I haven't been able to confirm this, saying, hey, look, I had a kid. Isn't this great? I'm so happy. You know, we have a Facebook kind of thing. And the church got a hold of this and said, listen, people know publicly that you're gay. We're demoting you. I haven't heard that they fired her. She's claiming they fired her. They say they've just given her non-teaching duty. So she's doing bookkeeping or marking grades and stuff.
They basically told her to go work from home. It is still a paid position, but in the eyes of someone who teaches, that's basically being fired from your teaching.
Now, where this becomes an issue that Ethan has close to the heart and myself do, is that this school receives a significant amount of its funding from public funds. It's a public school in that sense. And as a government-type institution, obviously you don't have the same freedom you would as a private institution, so discrimination based on someone's sexual orientation seems to be a no-brainer, as in, no, you can't do this. Even though you might say you're a private school, you get public funds, so you can't do that kind of thing.
Actually, in most provinces, it doesn't even matter if you're a completely private employer, no public money. The human rights code of whatever province applies to you still for employment. And for both of these cases, I'm looking at the Ontario one here. You are not allowed to hire or fire people based off of creed or sexual orientation. So both of these cases seem to be illegal under the law. Not sure why no one ever takes the Catholic schools up on this, but
yeah,
I think someone should do that.
From what I understand, though, the teacher that was demoted is actually pursuing this as a legal action.
Yeah, I remember reading about this as well, and the one thing that does sort of make me pause is that the school itself, as far as I know, has not commented yet, probably because there might be a lawsuit pending. So we don't entirely know the full story. But if what the allegations are even remotely true, then it does seem like a human rights violation, clear and pretty simple.
And I think it points to the basic problem is why is public money going to these religious institutions? I mean, both of these cases show how it seems to be so inappropriate and out of place with what our society expects and wants.
Well, that's a really good question. And hopefully some of our listeners will take that question up themselves.
And if you agree or disagree or just want to find out more about these kinds of issues, you can look up the Canadian Secular Alliance, which is concerned with lobbying for separation of church and state and these kinds of issues with the Canadian government.
We'll have a links to the Canadian Secular Alliance on our webpage. Well, let's go to a commercial break, and when we come back, we'll have the Globe and Mail's Andre Picard, and he'll be talking to us about polio and vaccines.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
Here on Radio Free Thinker, we've discussed what many consider the most important breakthrough in medical science, vaccines, and the resulting eradication of many diseases. However, we typically discuss this from a North American point of view. Here to help us understand the worldwide implications of vaccines and wiping out diseases is the Globe and Mail's public health reporter, Andre Picard. Andre, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker.
Hi.
So you recently wrote a piece for the Globe and Mail called Why Won't Polio Go Away? For people in North America, polio is a thing of the past. Where is polio still a threat?
Polio is still a threat essentially in Southeast Asia and in parts of Africa. So it's really localized around two main countries, India, Nigeria, and then to a lesser extent, Afghanistan and Pakistan. But those are big, big countries, very populous, so there's still a lot of polio out there.
Right. You mentioned that Central Asia was declared polio-free in 2002, but in your article you mentioned how in 2001 there were only 483 cases in four countries, but in 2009 that jumped to 1,606 cases in 23 countries. How and why is this happening?
Essentially, we see flare-ups because polio travels easily. It just takes an infected person. They don't even have to know it. They travel to another country, infect a water supply, a sewage system, because it's spread through feces. And it spreads very, very quickly. It's a disease that spreads readily and often invisibly. So it's one of the worst-case scenario for public health officials. You don't see it coming, and then it's there. So this week we have this huge outbreak in Tajikistan, a place that hasn't had polio for a decade, and all of a sudden it's arrived, and it's arrived in force.
And you mentioned in your article that $8.2 billion, along with the World Health Organization and volunteers and charitable actions, still haven't stopped polio. Does this suggest that it's too biologically wily for us, or are there some other explanations for its survival as a disease?
I don't think the problem is scientific or biological. As viruses go, it's very simple. It doesn't compare, say, to AIDS or even the flu in terms of getting control of it. So it's very simple biologically. The problem is a political one. It's a religious one. It's a desire one. So if we really put our minds to it, we could have eradicated polio already. But, you know, there's been all these campaigns in Nigeria, for example. There was religious opposition. conspiracy theory that the vaccine was being used to sterilize young women, it led to a massive resurgence of polio. Just a simple conspiracy theory like that that had no credence whatsoever, and we saw this massive revival at a time where it was getting very close to being wiped out. So these little things, politics, war, all infectious diseases spread quite readily, and when there's conflict and disaster like war and refugee movements. So all these things are the problem, not the biology. That's the simple part.
Okay. So you mentioned the religious problem. How do health agencies typically approach a problem like that?
Well, it's a very difficult one. You know, public health is used to just sort of giving these almost quasi-religious-like messages. It's good to be vaccinated, accept that at face value, and people tend to go along. So when you're faced with another kind of similar message, it says the opposite. Public health is not very good at fighting back traditionally. So they've been losing those battles. So I think what they've learned to do is to try and be more diplomatic. So they've gone to talk to imams in Nigeria, to the reasonable ones, which, you know, are the vast majority. And they've made movement within the more radical community to convince people that, listen, this isn't the case. Vaccination is beneficial, even for very devout Muslims, and it's going to save everybody's children regardless of their religion. So I think they've gotten a lot smarter about these things. And we see a similar situation with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Not exactly a religious movement, but a fundamentalist movement where they've assassinated vaccination workers, saying they're agents of Western imperialism, etc. And you have to do that through diplomatic channels and say, listen, there is such a thing as neutrality, and there is such a thing as a program that's good for everybody, regardless of their politics.
Right. And so getting back to sort of the Taliban, for instance, why is it in their best interest to attack health volunteers?
Well, I think if you look at it rationally, it's definitely not in their interest. Now, why do they do it? They do it because it's just sort of this blanket attacking of Westerners is going to terrorize people and give them control. So it's not a very thoughtful action, but it's just done, you know, in broad sweeps. And we do that in the West, too. We have programs that are not very thoughtful, and that's a similar reaction from another side. So I think you have to go in there and you have to sell those programs, even in very difficult circumstances, and particularly in difficult circumstances. I think it's easier to do polio vaccination in Canada. It's a lot more difficult in Afghanistan, and that the Taliban is just one of the reasons.
Right. Well, getting back to the science for a moment, what are the different strategies we have for dealing with the different types of polio? You mentioned type 1 and type 3.
Yes, so there's three types of polio. Type 1 is the most virulent. It's the one that cripples and kills the most people. Type 3 is more in Africa. It's fairly crippling as well. And type 2 is essentially eradicated. It doesn't exist anymore. It was always the lesser problem, but it's gone. So we're, you know, a third of the way there, but the other two-thirds are much more difficult to accomplish.
So what are your thoughts on the technology behind vaccines? In Canada, we saw a delay of the H1N1 vaccine because the technology behind its creation wasn't that efficient. Could improvements to technology help the situation with polio as well?
Well, with polio, we essentially have 50-year-old technology. So it's a very old-fashioned vaccine. It works pretty well. But you have, for example, it doesn't compare to H1N1. We're talking a different era of vaccination. It's very simple. We have oral polio in much of the developing world. So there's good and bad. The bad thing about oral polio vaccine is it's live virus. So you can actually get polio from the virus, and it happens in some cases, which has made it difficult to sell the vaccination program in some places. Now, the good thing is that the live virus sheds. So you can essentially immunize people. When there's feces in the water, people are going to get the toned-down virus, and they're going to get some immunization through drinking dirty water, which is an odd public health measure, but it actually works fairly well. So that old-fashioned technology has its benefits. But if we're going to eradicate polio, and we're getting very close to that, we're going to have to get rid of live virus. There's no question. Otherwise, it's going to continue to exist out there. So there's a technological challenge that's coming, and we're almost having to deal with that.
And you mentioned in your article that there are significant doubts now about the eradication plan. In your opinion, is the program, though, salvageable? Can we achieve this?
I think it's one of those programs where we've invested so much time and energy and we're so close. You know, imagine 1,000 cases or 1,600 cases of a disease in the entire world of 6 billion people. It's really close to eradication, and it has no animal reservoir. So I think, you know, there's a real, it's going to be really symbolic when it's done. And I think for that reason, as much as any, the investment we've done so far, it's probably worth doing that extra push, even if it's probably be a couple of billion dollars more. But there's going to be tremendous savings. If we could stop in 5 or 10 years vaccinating for polio the way we stopped with smallpox, it frees up all that money that's spent every year to undertake other programs, whether they're eradication or disease control measures. You know, smallpox saved a tremendous amount of lives, but also saved a lot of money that was invested in other things like stopping measles, et cetera, real killers of children around the world. You know, in Canada, again, we forget this stuff, but measles kills a lot of people, just like polio and just like smallpox used to.
And so dealing with the countries that you mentioned before, Afghanistan and the religious fundamental countries, are we going to have to see political stability arrive to these countries before we can really help them move beyond polio?
I think probably political stability is too much to hope for. You know, we have to be realistic. There's always been war and disruption in the world, and that's going to continue to exist. I think what we have to do is have much more targeted programs. To have initiatives like in Nigeria, when there was war, they actually had a polio ceasefire. So all the sides in the conflict took 2 days of ceasefire. They said, we're going to vaccinate every child in the country with polio in those 2 days. It's a massive effort. And it was a wonderful thing. You know, it was a little glimmer of hope in a country where there's not a lot of hope and where there's a lot of bloodshed. So I think those kinds of initiatives, if people buy into them, that's going to be the way to go. And hopefully that leads to, you know, broader peace talks, et cetera. But I think public health has to take its ends where it can.
That's a great story. But talking about sort of locally, you mentioned how the G8 countries are really sort of funding this. Are you concerned with the recent rise of the anti-vax movement in the United States, Canada, and the UK, that they could put pressure on politicians to stop funding vaccination efforts?
You know, I think the anti-vaccine movement is loud and it's present on the internet, but it's really marginal. So to me, it's sort of the equivalent of, you know, are we going to listen to the Taliban to establish our foreign policy? Are we going to listen to the anti-vaccine people? It's, you know, they're not as violent, et cetera, but it's about the same level of marginality, if you allow me. So I don't think that's going to have an influence. I think what's going to have a much bigger impact is G8 countries have a lot more domestic concerns with the recession, with the credit crisis. They're looking for ways to cut money. It's easy to forget the poor child in Pakistan or Nigeria who could, you know, have a whole lifetime of hope by getting a polio vaccine. It's easy to turn a blind eye to them if you're totally focused on domestic concerns. So I think the benefit of doing stories like this is reminding our politicians that, you know, we live in this broader world, and in the grand scheme of things, this isn't a lot of money, and it can have a tremendous impact. And, it, you know, if we want to be selfish about it, and it's going to have a benefit to us. We get a lot of immigrants from these countries that have polio. There's a lot fewer people with disabilities. There's going to be a lot more healthy immigrants. So we can look at it in any manner we want, as selfishly as we want, and it's still a good investment.
Well, I think that most of our listeners would probably agree with you that it's probably better to help these people without hoping to get something back, but just sort of to improve public health in the world. And Andre, I want to thank you for stopping by and discussing this important issue, and I hope you'll keep writing about vaccines and polio in the future and eventually give us the good news that it's all gone.
Well, thank you. I look forward to the day where I can give you more good news.
Excellent. Thanks, Andre.
Take care.
Sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all in a fire.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh, yeah.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. And we're going to be talking about social learning.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker, and we're going to be talking about social learning.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker, and we're going to talk about social learning.
I'm not putting you guys through another one.
you might be wondering why we're doing this. There was a research project released recently by the St. Andrews University in Scotland by Kevin Lillard and Luke Randall, among others, who are doing some computer simulations of evolutionary strategies of learning. And the strategy that worked out best was one that relied heavily on copying others. So unlike what we think today, that if you want to become a successful person in our societies, you need to be a maverick. You need to go where no one has gone before, and that's how you'll do it. According to this model, really what works is you sit there and you look what everyone else is doing, and if it's worked for him for a long time, then you should try and maybe do that too.
So what they did with this study was they set it up as a competition, and labs from all over the world could participate and set up basically a program that would live in this simulated world that sort of simulated competition for resources and getting food and finding shelter and things like that, very roughly. And their program would encode some kind of strategy for what to do to survive as long as they could in this world, this simulated world. And the strategies that copied what other people did really well. So there were strategies that basically did things randomly. There were strategies that only stole from other people. There were strategies that sat around and did nothing. There were strategies that, I think I may have already mentioned, but this did random things. But the ones where they copied what other people did successfully did the best.
What do you mean by copy exactly?
Actually, I think the best way, the way the researchers that I was listening to made a point out is that, let's say you were in the computer world, and I'm making this part up, but it's a good example. Let's say you wanted to know how to get out of a room, right? Now, one way to do that is to be innovative. Say, okay, I'm going to go left, and I hit the wall. Then I'm going to go right, and I'm going to hit the wall. And that requires a fair amount of energy to figure out which way it was. Now, another strategy you do is you sit back and you wait till someone else gets out of the room and you say, oh, that person did this. I will copy what they did. So that's kind of what they mean is that some people will sit there and they'll innovate. That's why one of the important words here is rely heavily as opposed to solely on copying. You need some form of innovation in the system. But as far as a personal strategy, it requires less expenditure of resources, less risk for me to copy someone else who's already learned something than to try and learn something new myself.
Okay, so then this needs, though, someone to innovate first for group learning to progress then.
Right. Not necessarily innovate. If random chance someone else's random simulation does the right thing and then you copy it, then you're fine.
Yeah,
but there doesn't need to be any particular planning behind it.
Then you're gambling on randomness. So if we have a room with, you know, five people in it, the first person to get up and try to leave that room is going to have to do some guessing. Like, they're going to have to say, okay, I'll try walking left, and they'll hit the wall. I'm going to try walking right, I'm going to hit the wall. They're going to have to try. So if he doesn't do anything, nobody learns, or...
Well, that's why this strategy, as Don said, relies heavily on copying, but still has some element of innovation or randomness in it, so that if he does get the chance to go first, that and there's no one else to copy, he'll be able to do something.
So part of it would be, so we used the five people in the room, right?
Mm-hmm.
And okay, I'm going to copy whoever moves first. And I'm going to, so I'll wait. I don't do anything. And I'm not wasting any resources by not doing anything, or at least the way the model kind of worked. But at some point, I'm going to sit there and say, okay, nothing has happened, and I want to prosper. So I'm going to break from my copying routine, and I'm going to try something. I might try a directed strategy or a random strategy. And once the first person does that, that gives the other people something to work on. And maybe I'll go left and it failed. So the next person who's in the list will copy, not left, right? Because mm-hmm. another way of copying someone else's behavior is to know that's not something to do, right? So it's a negative learning, but it's still a form of learning.
Okay. I'm not sure if the simulation was that detailed. It's possible that the getting out of a room example that we're using is far more complex than the actual simulation was, but I'm sure that at least some of the teams have put up their programs and routines so that people can look at them.
Interesting. It just seems to me that that's one experiment on a very kind of open idea that's very, in my opinion, very hard to nail down to a cause an effect situation here. I mean, I think, you know, learning is very, I don't know, situation driven. And like Don said, you could have someone kind of, you know, walk into the wall, you go, okay, I know not to do that. I don't know if I'd characterize that as copying, though. I think I'd more characterize that as sort of, you know, observe and compute, you know, okay, walking to the wall, bad, walking through door, good. I'll take that action.
I do know, sorry, you go first.
Well, it's still a form of copying. Like, to an extent, learning is copying. You're taking what other people have done or what other people have written about what they've done, and then you're sort of copying that into what you know.
I think to make you feel a little bit better, Ethan, and to make sure everyone understands that none of us, actually one of us is a psychologist, but none of us are evolutionary psychologists. So these were mathematical models, and they weren't simple models, but they tried to replicate simple learning. So you're right, the nuances are very great. And actually, one of the things they said is that the learning that they had was based upon the actual traits themselves and not on the learner. And one of the things he suggested, well, one of the things you might do as a follow-up to this experiment is older learnings would be given greater weight. So you would be more likely to learn behaviors from older simulated creatures in this model than younger ones, which again points to this is a simulation and there's a lot of nuance to it. If anyone's ever played that simple game of life where, you know, small little things have massive effects, but how it actually works is deep in the math and I think beyond most of our comprehension here, except for maybe Rob's.
I have heard of other simulation style studies where economists and psychologists will run simulations or have actual subjects do economic exchanges, and they'll find that strategies called tit for tat, where you do something in return for something someone else did. Like you copy them, whether they did something positive or negative towards you.
Well, that's game theory, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's related to this in that copying what someone else did ended up being a more effective economic strategy in the long run than trying something different. And so I think what we can take away from this and how it links up with other similar studies like the economic simulations is not that social learning is driven entirely by copying, but that if the majority of the population only copies, but there are still a few people that try new things, then that works. That is sufficient for social learning in the long run?
From this very simple model. And I think going on with our talk about the similarities between the human and Neanderthal genome is this points in a direction but doesn't actually come with any hard, fast conclusions. It's just a, hey, this is an interesting effect. We should maybe do more research in this area because it looks like something's there. This actually reminded me a lot about Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, and if I remember seeing the show on that, he used almost a very similar type of statistical model, but very simple because it was back in the 80s. So,
yeah, it's good to point out that this doesn't really prove anything. It's just sort of a tool used to guide people towards what might be pushing evolution onward and what might work in evolutionary terms.
And I think if you think
social learning terms, rather.
Well, social learning, but also, like, fundamentally latent in this is that maybe we have evolved to sort of copy like we do.
And actually, if you think about it, I mean, how much of the stuff do you do in a day did you invent? And how much of it is it you learned from somewhere else or you saw something else or we were taught, right?
Babies, humans, other primates, we all show copying behaviors all the time.
So this evidence confirms what we already knew.
Maybe, maybe not.
And in the same way that we get confirmation bias when we said, well, what's the difference between Neanderthals and humans? Well, we were looking for things, so we might be interpreting more into this. But again, like I say, it's evidence, it's pointing in a direction. Hopefully there'll be more follow-up and more complex studies.
It's something that means something. We're not sure what it means yet, but
well,
it means something.
On the topic of humans and Neanderthals, one reason people think we out-competed the Neanderthals was because we were way better at copying each other, because copying is how cool ideas spread. So these groups of humans that were living in the same area as Neanderthals in Europe at the time were able to spread their ideas and their successful, you know, hunting strategies or shelter creating strategies, creation of fire, whatever you want to come up with. Whereas the Neanderthals didn't have this copying strategy, and so it didn't spread as much, and that leads to out competition.
I'm pretty sure Neanderthals had fire. But anyway, we should move on to another very important issue, and that is British electoral reform.
Actually, it's called the United Kingdom, just so everyone... that's it. No, that's important because Britain and the United Kingdom do have slightly different things. The election he's referring to, which Daniel has an extensive discussion about, involves the Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, and Rob's phone, and England.
So we'll just pause for a moment while Rob answers his phone.
Yeah.
Nice ringtone there.
Daniel, I was up all night.
I want to learn more about England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales.
Well, I was up all night watching this election because I'm a political wonk.
You beat me. I only stayed up till like 2. I got kind of bored.
I kept asking people on Twitter and online and in chat rooms, like, who's won? Who's won? And everyone kept saying,
watch BBC.
Actually, that was hilarious because there's a show I like to watch, Have I Got News For You, which is a UK kind of game show. Political show, and they specially preempted the show one night, and the thing said, we preempted the show so that we would know what the outcome of the elections would be, and then there was this pause, but that didn't work.
Well, anyways, the UK elections have just recently occurred. I'm not sure how much people know about these elections, but they were pretty controversial, pretty I don't know. Lots of people are tired of politics as usual, and I air quote here, in the UK, which is what happens at every election everywhere. Then it just goes back to usual after the election. But there was quite a swing in votes from last time, but maybe not as much of a swing as there could have been. Just to quickly run down the results, the Conservative Party won with 306 seats and 36.1% of the votes. Labour came in second with 258 and 29% of the votes. And then the Liberal Democrats got 57 seats and 23% of the votes.
Sound familiar?
It actually is pretty similar to Canadian elections. There's a lot more other small parties in the UK because you have Scotland, Wales, Ireland. They have their little parties. But if you were listening closely there, you might have heard me say 57 seats, yet 23% of the vote for the Liberal Democrats, compared to just 6% more of the vote for the Labour Party, and over 200 more seats. I'm not sure how many people would say that is fair, but...
Probably none.
But that's what the current system does. To people who are familiar with the Canadian electoral system, which I'm going to assume you are if you're Canadian... the UK uses pretty much the exact same one. They use first-past-the-post and single-member districts to elect people. So basically, whoever gets the most votes in a district wins. This could be 20% of the votes if there's lots of different parties and people getting small amounts. So you don't need a majority. I'll go through some of the good part or the good things of this system and the bad. Depending on what you think of this, it creates fake majorities, which is good for some people, bad for others. Basically, what this means is that a party with 38% of the vote or so could get a majority of seats in the parliament. And obviously, a party with a majority of the seats can more effectively govern. They can, from their point of view, they can more effectively govern. Others might disagree, but they can more easily get their policies in.
So basically, you're saying that the first-past-the-post system that we have right now, one of the advantages is it leads to a stable and somewhat predictable government system because you're pretty much almost always guaranteed, recent exceptions in mind, to have a majority government no matter how the voting may split up.
Mm-hmm. Within the UK, this is the first minority, or it could be a coalition, but non-majority government in, I think, about 30 years.
74 was the last one with the Howard government.
A little over 30 years. Canada recently has had lots of minority governments, but we have been fairly similar if you look at our political history as a whole. But on some bad parts of the system, it leads to wasted votes. If you don't vote for the person who got elected, your vote in essence didn't matter.
Well, wait a minute. That's not really true, is it?
Yes.
If the person you vote for doesn't win, it's a wasted vote?
Roughly, if the person you vote for doesn't win, then your vote doesn't get counted in the final results.
That's how democracy works.
No, that's how this system of elections in democracy works.
No, I mean, if you have a choice and your choice isn't chosen, your choice still counts. It just didn't get enough of it, so it didn't win.
Now, I think the best example of this, and you get this in Canada sometimes, right, where you'll have one particular electoral place where you might get 20% vote for NDP, 22% vote for Liberal, and 23% vote for Conservative. Now, the NDP and the Liberals are more left of center than the Conservatives. So you would think that there should be a left of center type representative from there. But because you get the right of center, essentially the will of those other people are not only, I mean, we use the term thrown out, but I mean, it no longer represents the will of the people in that particular district. Even though you're right, it technically amounts to a higher score, but it doesn't really, the people who voted for the third parties or whatever don't have a chance to
win. When I say votes are wasted, I mean it in more of a statistical, mathematical way. A perfect, and I air quote here, electoral system, everyone's vote would count the exact same amount. Now, I'm not just saying that they'd have a vote and something would happen because of the vote, but I'm saying whoever gets elected is fundamentally based upon every single vote.
And that requires kind of like Frankenstein-type politician of mixed parts.
There are some mathematical reasons why these kinds of voting systems lead to what some people assume are wasted votes or non-proportional governments or things like that, which I'll explain a little later.
Mm-hmm. And basically most mathematicians have said that that's impossible, but that's the theoretical system that I would argue any practical system should head for. And first past the post is pretty much the worst you can get.
So what are some other
Hold on. Let's talk about that for a moment. Mm-hmm. First past the post works for a representational democracy, which is what I understand Canada and the UK use.
Actually, but see, that's the thing. It's actually a representational democracy, because although that person may have got the most votes in the seat, he doesn't actually represent the leaning sympathies. So again, a great example here is we have the idea, and I think Daniel would go into this, the idea of strategic voting. Now, in England, a lot of people were suspected to go for Lib Dems, which is their sort of third party in that country, because they did really, really well in the public debates. But it turns out that, and one of the things that was used is, well, if you vote for Lib Dem, Lib Dems will never get enough votes in any one district, so you're wasting your votes. And really what you want to do is you want to vote for Labour because they more reflect your view than the Conservatives, and you get this idea of strategic voting. And again, that's where it becomes misrepresentational.
Yeah, and I fully get that, but again, I think that's the problem of the politics of the day. In theory, how this is supposed to work is that each community essentially elects a representative who goes to Parliament and speaks on that community's behalf. Now, if you have, you know, a prime minister who wants everybody to vote in line and not express personal opinion, that's a problem for this system. But this, if the system works correctly and you have MPs who are allowed to voice their opinion based on what their community wants, in theory, it should work fine.
Well, it comes down to whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing that any particular district can elect a representative who does not represent the majority of the constituents. So in first past the post, you can have a representative elected in a district with only 30% of the votes.
But that's democracy, though.
Well, no, you see,
the majority gets their way. Even if that majority is a small majority, it's still the majority.
Here we have a very interesting aspect of it. One, we have the idea of electoral districts, and they gerrymander them, so you get the right number of votes in each one. But Churchill had said democracy is the worst possible system you can have except for all the others. Now, first past the post is a form of democracy, and it does create democratic results in air quotes. But I think what the idea of this segment we were trying to get at, is there other ways of doing the same thing that would lead to a better representation of that,
I think,
of that particular constituency? So it's not that the first past the post doesn't represent the people at all. It does. It is a form of democracy. It's much better than me going in there saying, hey, actually, no, it'd be better if I said that. But it's a good form of representational democracy. But are there better systems of it that allow everyone, even those who didn't vote for person X to still have a proportional vote, a proportional voice in the way government's running. And I think that's really where Daniel would like to continue this conversation, is the whole idea of are there alternative systems to first past the post?
Yes, we got a little into what democracy should be there, which we may talk about one day, but back to electoral systems a little bit. In front of you right now, I have a map of the election results in England, or in the UK. And basically what you have in UK politics right now is you have a South England that largely goes conservative, a North England that is a little split between Labour and conservative, but fairly Labour-heavy. And then you have a Scotland that largely goes Liberal Democrat and Scottish National Party. And then Ireland that goes a whole bunch of random little parties. But the problem with this, the problem that you get with this is now you have Southern England that largely only has conservative representatives in the parliament. There's a few problems there. A lot of people in Southern England did not vote conservative. A lot of them voted Labour, a lot of them voted Liberal Democrats. And if you took out strategic voting, which is a huge part of First Past the Post, they might even be more towards Liberal Democrats or more towards Labour.
So just to keep this moving along, maybe. So basically what you're saying, and I'm going to use one that I know a little bit better. In Scotland, there was something like 13 or so percent of the population voted for Conservative, but they have absolutely no representation from Scotland there. So the idea is with beyond first past the post, is there another election system that might allow this these 13% of conservative Scotch people to have one or two people actually representing their view in the national parliament? What are the alternatives to first past the post?
Well, it would take me forever to go through every alternative, but I'll just go through two of the more popular ones. These don't require fundamentally huge changes in how elections run. Like, you don't need one giant riding where everyone's elected proportionally. I think Rob has something to say.
The first one that you're going to talk about may be familiar to some people in BC because it is the single transferable vote about which we had a referendum recently.
That was actually going to be the second one, but the first one I'm going to talk about is the alternate vote system. This one is actually pretty widely used in parliamentary democracies. Australia and New Zealand use it, I believe. So it works easily. Like, there's no problems with using it in any other countries, which you'll hear a lot of the time from people against electoral reform. They'll be like, it's so difficult and voters can't understand it, but that's nonsense. But the thing with alternate vote is it's basically first past the post, but you get to put a second choice on it.
Essentially, the way the ballot works is you rank the people. So you have this guy's number one, this guy's number two, this guy's number three. Whoever has the least number ones gets dropped from the vote, and all his number twos go to whoever. So it's more representative than first past the post, but it still has the same inherent biases that you'd still get.
Exactly. The Electoral Reform Society of the UK actually looked at the results that would have happened if alternate vote was in place. Obviously, this is not perfect because people might have voted completely differently with a different system. But using the best they can do, they would have found that the Conservatives would have got about 20 less seats, Labour would have gotten about 4 more, and the Liberal Democrats would have receive more than 20 more. And so obviously it would have a huge effect on the parliament. This isn't a tiny change. This is a pretty massive change.
And I think the thing that makes this one popular to one aspect of those people is the idea is that it only changes the ballot. Nothing else has to be changed. So all the electoral districts are still the same. The party structure can still remain the same. You're just actually changing the ballot. And it's more proportional than the other ones, but not as proportional as other alternatives.
Exactly. I mean, to think about it like this, say there was an election between all four of us for Radio Freethinker, and if we had a normal one, let's say the votes were pretty evenly split between Ethan and Don, and let's say it was like 48-48, and Rob and I got the other couple percent. But, so with that, actually, let's say it was 48-49 for Don. So Don would have won in that case. The problem is if you had alternate vote, let's say the alternate for the people who voted for Rob and Daniel would have been Ethan. Ethan would therefore have gotten 59% of the vote if you include those alternates, and is actually more liked in general in that district.
I think if there's a website that actually has this, a very good example of this. But okay, so we've got the alternative alternative voting system, which is simple to enforce, but not as representative of everyone's wishes as you can. So we also have another version that we know very well in BC and for some inexplicable reason didn't vote for. But
yes, this one is the single transferable vote. What this one does is it changes the district so that the districts have at least two people in them. More likely it's going to have 4 to 7 people in the districts. And then what people do is they rank every candidate who runs in those districts, well, as many as they want, but conceivably every candidate from 1 to 20, let's say, if it's a huge district. Then using a system that sounds complicated but actually isn't, the people are chosen basically off of who's most well-liked in the district. By people as a whole, not by their first preferences only, but also by their other preferences.
So the point of this one is it's like the alternative vote in the sense that you know, you have a first ranking system, but because it's in a larger electoral district, it's more like straight proportional representation where you just don't get one vote, you get a series based upon the percentage of that particular district.
Yes, it's not quite proportional representation in the strictest sense. You still get to vote for individuals rather than parties, and you won't have an exact mix or exact equality between percentage voted for one party and percentage of seats.
And that's one of those things that's seen as an advantage to this over direct proportionality, where everyone votes in the country and they just split up based on the percentage, is because you still have some accountability to a regional office. Like this, there may be 3 representatives for my particular riding based on a proportion, but they're my riding and I can go and kick their butt if I want to, whereas you don't get that in pure proportional systems.
Exactly. It's a mixture of representative democracy or peer representative democracy, where you have a representative for your area who goes to the parliament and argues for you, and sort of more ideological representation, which is more of what proportional does.
Right. So as I see it, then it's not objectively better than the other system. It's simply a different system. I mean, I can already see plenty of problems that could arise. For example, here in Canada, you know, what city dominates Canadian politics the most?
No, but that actually doesn't come into it as much as any more than it does right now, because you don't have any more seats or anything, right?
You just said you could have up to 20 people from one district.
Exactly. Though. But what you would do is you would take 20 districts and you would group them together as one mega district that elects 20 representatives.
You would never do 20, but...
Exactly.
So inconceivably, one big area could have a huge percentage of MPs from that area.
No,
because it's the same number as before.
Yeah, so it's the same number of seats. You're not changing the number. All you're doing is... Basically, in a pure proportional system, let's say all of Canada was pure proportional, everyone casts their votes, and the Conservatives get 20%, the Liberals get 22%, the NDP get 53%, and then you take the number of seats in the House and you split them up like that. Now, that's great. You get absolute pure proportionality representation. Everyone who votes gets their share of the vote, but you have no accountability, as in they don't represent any one area. So what you would do in the simpler state is you say BC has... 47, or I forget how many. We'll say BC has 47. So you do a proportional representation for BC. Still same number of seats, but it's only the BC people who get to vote for that. So you get more accountability. Now, STV takes that same idea and just shrinks it down. So you have districts of about 4 or 5 people in them. So there, it's pure proportionality in that seat, but it's still the same number of seats you'd have over the country overall. So BC, Vancouver would still have the same number of seats. Just it would be allocated pure proportionally.
Yeah, but again, though, you're saying that you would have a representation of what BC wants, though. How would you guarantee that, say, the NDP candidate from BC is from the riding that they were elected from?
Well, again, that's where STV's comes into it is the idea is it shrinks the districts down so that they're still representative. So you don't have, like I said, I used all of BC just as an example, but the seats themselves would only be 4 or 5 representatives. So it would still only be a small geographical area.
The best way to think about this is take Surrey. I think Surrey has about 400,000, 500,000 people, so that'd be 4 or 5 electoral districts. Let's just go with 5 under the current first-past-the-post system. So they'd have 5 MPs going to Ottawa. Under the STV system, rather than 5 separate electoral districts where 5 MPs are elected separately, there would be 1 electoral district where 5 MPs are elected for all of Surrey. Same number of MPs for the same geographic area, same population area. Just, it's a different way of electing them. It's not fundamentally, they're random.
In theory, though, couldn't you have, like, if it's five districts in one city, you could have all 5 politicians come from the same district.
There wouldn't be those districts to compare that to. But as of right now, I mean, MPs don't really necessarily live in the district they're
elected. I know. From. That's a fault of the system, though. But not, in theory, if it worked properly, that's how it
would be. But here's the thing. You could have, in those 5 districts, all 5 of them going to the Conservative Party, even though only 22% of the people voted for that, which seems to be wrong if you want representational democracy. Whereas with the STV, all those 5, you still get 22% go Conservative, but then whatever percentage of the other parties, up to a bare minimum, represent the people. So it's a more accurate representation of Surrey, even though you're right, they may all go to that, but they're all from Surrey, right? I mean, the person who represents me in Ottawa doesn't live in my neighborhood. Right? So do they have to live in my neighborhood for me to vote? No. So there's some accommodation, there's some limitations, and they're accountable. So if they all come from one particular area of the city, then I just won't vote for the party that does that. If there's another party that says, well, we've got split up all over the place, go, well, that's better. And that's how competitive democracy works. Rob?
If I can shift gears here a little bit, because we're actually over time, but the show after us is going to start a little late, so we can afford to take a little more time. But I found an article on The New Scientist by Ian Stewart, who is a mathematician and science popularizer in the UK. And he basically wrote this article called Electoral Dysfunction, which discusses why elections pretty much have to be unfair no matter what method you use. So we've been discussing a lot about FTP, or rather First Past the Post and STV, but there are other systems, and all of them have their problems. And he, Ian Stewart, wrote some very clever and simple descriptions of the main problems with some of these systems. So I'll just go through a couple of those examples. Number one was with First Past the Post. Imagine that you're having a vote between 15 people at a bar or a restaurant or something about what beverages they prefer. And there are 3 choices: milk, wine, and beer. So imagine you have 6 people ranking their votes inwardly. They prefer milk to wine to beer. 5 people prefer beer to wine to milk. And 4 people prefer wine to beer to milk. So under First Past the Post, only their first ranking counts, because in First Past the Post, you don't get to vote for any of your other preferences. You just vote for the one you prefer the most. So this would result in a ranking of milk to beer to wine. But 9 people in total prefer beer to milk. 9 people in total prefer wine to milk. And 10 people prefer wine to beer. So the actual preferences of the voting population is wine preferred to beer, preferred to milk, which is the exact opposite ranking that First Past the Post gave you. So if there are systems where you can take First Past the Post style voting and you will get the, you know, milk would be the winner in that system, where beer and wine respectively will get less seats, but the actual preferences of the voting public go in the complete opposite direction. And a mathematician called Donald Sari at University of California, Irvine, proved that for any voting system, given any set of voter preferences, you can design a system that produces any result you want. So there's a little problem there.
So there you go. And this is what I've said before, is that democracy doesn't work. We should get rid of it. Let's just put me in charge.
Actually, one thing that I found was really interesting is that there's an economist and mathematician named Keith Arrow, who in 1963 talked to a lot of different people and proposed four axioms, if you will, for an idealized fair voting system. So people all seem to agree on these four points as being desirable if you want a fair voting system. Number one, voters should be able to express a complete set of their preferences. They shouldn't have to only vote for the one they want the most. They should be able, in an idealized system, to say, well, I like this guy better than this guy, but I like the second guy better than this guy. Number two, no single voter should be allowed to dictate the outcome of the entire election. The outcome of who wins shouldn't hinge on just one person, because that one person will have disproportionate power over the rest of the voters.
That'd be like a king, wouldn't it?
By that is if you have a seat where there is the first and second person both have 10,000 votes, essentially one person determines who wins that seat.
I'm pretty sure in Canada, someone might have to correct this on me, is there's one person in every district that vote is reserved for a tie. The returning officer, I think this might be Britain actually, but the returning officer for each district, I believe their vote is actually reserved for a tie. So technically, if it gets down to that, their vote is the only vote that matters.
Okay, what's the next one?
Number three, if every voter prefers one candidate to another, the final ranking should reflect that fact. So if every single voter prefers wine to beer, the final ranking of who gets the number of seats should reflect that wine gets more seats than beer. And number four, the final one, if a voter prefers candidate A to candidate B, adding a third candidate shouldn't reverse their preference. So these all seem like four pretty reasonable idealized points for an idealized fair voting system. However, economists, Keith Arrow and many others, have proved that no system at all under any circumstances can satisfy all four of these conditions. In particular, and we saw it here when Don and Dan and everyone started jumping in on it, number two is really hard to satisfy if you're trying to satisfy the other three, namely that no single voter should be allowed to dictate the outcome of the entire election. What we find a lot in creating a system that tries to satisfy the ranking preferences is that one changed vote can change the preference order of the entire election. So mathematically, at a very basic level, no matter what system you choose, something is going to be broken. But in my personal opinion, and perhaps in some of the other opinions of the hosts here, I like the preference ranking more than I like single votes. You may disagree. Let us know at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Well, why don't we go to our skeptical highlights, as we are running out of time here. I have two quick ones. The BC Humanists are having their annual general meeting Friday the 14th at 7:30 at the Oak Ridge Senior Center. After the official meeting, they will be screening a Sam Harris TED Talk and then discuss the question of who has the better insight into the development of morality, Stephen Jay Gould or Sam Harris. Check that one out, Friday the 14th, 7:30. Oak Ridge Senior Center. Finally, Skeptics in the Pub is Tuesday the 18th at 7:30 at the Railway Club. You all know about that, so go to it and have fun, drink, and be merry.
I have one here. This I thought it was tonight, but it was actually last night. The Canadian Institute for Advanced Research is having a contest, and they're going across the country, and they were here yesterday, about the next big question. This is like, what is the next big thing the human race has to worry about? And it's got things about, you know, oil and peace and global warming and all that. It's an interesting, if you go to the internet and you type in I'll have it up on the website. Or you can go CIFAR, next big question. It'll still show up. It's a very interesting thing to get into. We might even have some shows on these questions. They're pretty cool.
Some of you may know that I attended a conference this past weekend called Northern Voice, which is about social media, blogging, and web culture. There were actually a couple of local skeptics from the community there, a couple of people who went to skeptic camp. But there was one talk that I found particularly interesting by someone who works on campus here at the Michael Smith Laboratories named David Eng. And he was talking about a project called Philomon, which attempts to replicate the Pokemon card game, but with actual animals, in response to some research that a researcher in Cambridge in the UK found that school children were able to name on average 120 different Pokemon characters, while they could only name about 30 of the most common plants and animals in the area where they lived. So if you care about science outreach and teaching science, check out philomon.org.
Oh, okay, so that's it. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a good evening.
This is Daniel saying thanks for listening.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way